Okay, we're going to go. Hi, this is Michael Waitz, and welcome back to the Asia InsurTech Podcast. This is the only podcast in Asia focused on insurance that gives entrepreneurs, thought leaders, and investors a platform to discuss how technology is reshaping the insurance industry in Asia. Today, I am joined by John Moore, the founder of Ikigai Partners. I do love that name, John. It's great to have you on the show. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks, Michael. Thanks for having me.
It is my pleasure. Okay, look, let's just jump right in. What do you think is the biggest trend in InsurTech in Asia today?
I think it's an emerging trend, but I think it's going to become bigger and bigger, and that's the focus on the customer. If I look at the way insurance is sold across Asia and actually across Europe as well, the broker has always been at the center of the sales experience.
Interesting.
Going forward with tech and hence engagement, because let's be honest, insurance is not really the world's most engaging product, but it can be.
Yeah.
Then you don't want to engage with the broker. You need to engage with the end consumer. And I think while some other parts of the world, the broker's role has diminished very much to just commercial, in Asia, it's still very, very big in personal insurance. And I do see that insurance tech change that dramatically, because as people are targeting certain groups or they're looking at people's health behavior, then how do you do that if you're going through a third party? You have to get to the end customer. And I think you're going to see this journey from a B2B model terribly to a B2B2C model, but the end game that InsurTech is going to bring us, I think, is a B2C model in insurance, the same way it is in a lot of other consumer products.
So do you really think that over time, at least, that middleman, that the broker, is actually going to go away? Or do you think that there are just going to be so many fewer of them, but the good ones will stay there and that their roles will sort of be enhanced and supplemented by their ability to use what I'll call distribution technology and then customer service technology to give them ability to be like customer service superstars?
I think everyone overstates the ability of disruption to make things go away. It won't. And there'll be always some people who feel that trust and advice they want. But I think, you know, if you go to hyper-personalization, like I'll just give you one example.
Okay.
Cigna have a product in Hong Kong, which is very much targeted at people with diabetics.
Yep.
Which currently is a hard product to get insurance for.
Yeah.
Now, they offer benefits based on the individual actually managing their diabetes, signing up for the app, monitoring their health and so forth. Now, how do you do that with a broker? It's really, really hard, because it's ultimately the benefits come from the individual's behavior. So I think there'll be some layers of insurance where the benefits can only happen, particularly in the health side, if people are doing certain things. Now, once that hyper-personalization comes into play, then I think it's very hard for a broker to coexist. For the more aggregate products, I think the broker's role is as safe as it will ever be.
Okay, look, I want to talk a little bit more about this hyper-personalization and also this kind of direct-to-consumer. I don't necessarily disagree with you. We see it in a bunch of different verticals, right, not just in the insurance world. But before we do that, I want to get a bit of your background just so the listeners can have some context.
Sure. So, look, I'm an Australian. I'm on my third lap around the world, mainly working in banking, insurance, and telco. So I did the first lap, which was Australia to Canada to the UK, back to Australia, was predominantly driven on banking. I'm an economist by training and very much drove that whole customer focus bit. I've been CMO of a number of banks in Canada and Australia, and did a global role with Vodafone. The last few years has been predominantly on insurance, both in the general side and personal side with Suncorp in Australia. And in the last 7 years has been with Bupa, both in Australia, where I ran marketing and digital for the Australian New Zealand business, but then had the real privilege of working directly for my global CEO, driving the innovation strategy for Bupa globally out of London.
That's awesome.
And that's where we set up a little space called the Customer Lab. And in that, we had an accelerator that brought startups into it. We worked on our own sort of internal startup methodologies. And I also had the luxury of sitting on a couple of the key venture fund board. So I sat on the Blue Cross Blue Shield board out of the US, which is about 260 million US board, and also on an aged care VC fund as well. So it was a nice synergy of bringing together a real focus on the customer, which has been my marketing and chief customer officer type roles to date, both in banking and in telcos and insurance, into where could we go in the future.
So what was the genesis of this, of Bupa Labs, right? Bupa's customer lab. In other words, it seems very forward thinking in the sense that, you know, you want to go out, like you said, to be very customer focused, but then you set up this entire, I don't know if it's a division or just a section or whatever you'd call it, but to go out and do that, how does that happen inside a company and how does it get affected?
It was a year of hard work. So I was given a challenge by my CEO working with my peer in Spain, David Garcia, to actually look at how could Bupa play in the innovation space.
Right.
So we, as part, along with our day jobs, actually traveled the world, meeting with other corporations, other venture funds, startups, and seeing what worked and what didn't. Now, there are a couple of things that we learned from this is, one, we had no desire to be our own fund. We just didn't have the expertise or the risk profile to invest in a way that would actually give the company a return.
Interesting.
So, and the best example I got was from a Silicon Valley-based VC owner who actually made the comment to me, said, I'm putting $1 billion into this fund. Three companies will carry that fund. The rest won't go anywhere. Could you go to your board after having spent $500 million and say, I need another $100 million because there's something coming there?
Right.
And, you know, his throwaway line at the end was, and you're going to pay too much. You're going to pay me a lot of money for these companies, but it's still cheaper than you doing the alternative. And that was actually a really powerful way of describing it. The second thing we learned was that the word innovation and the word digital is everywhere out there.
Right.
But if you're not solving a customer problem, then you're just doing really cool stuff. And cool stuff doesn't give you a return. And that's why we call it the customer lab, not the digital lab or the innovation lab. Because
I was going to ask,
at the heart of it, was we wanted to solve problems that made a difference to our customers and then look at how could we apply tech towards it. Because in many cases, we also learned that big corporations are, and Bupa was a big corporation, are not necessarily set up to do really innovative stuff at the adjacent corner. Companies are very good at innovating internally. They wouldn't exist if they didn't. So they're improving their business model every day. We didn't find any examples of companies that are in that sort of, you know, what Google called the X Lab space, who just do weird stuff outside and somehow land something. That wasn't us. And we saw no companies where they could get traction in that space. We saw lots of companies doing work in almost like saying, could we rebuild ourselves? But we actually wanted to, we saw a really good niche for us, and this was for our culture, which was, how do you build something inside that has the freedom of outside but is connected to what you want to do? And for us, that was that key piece, which is connected to who we are. So our focus was on adjacent businesses. So, for example, we looked at, could you do AI in dentistry? We owned an AI, we owned a dentistry business. The two came together, but we weren't competing.
Okay.
That's very much the focus of the lab, was that sort of gap. And that's how we got there, was literally a year focus.
That's really interesting. You know, so many people want to get into the investment business, right? Because from the outside, it just looks really easy. You know, all I have to do is invest in, you know, pick a company, grab it, I'll make $1 billion. It's just that what the VC told you is definitely right. If you go and look at their return profiles, even their expected return profiles, over 80%, probably closer to 90%, will return either 0 times the money that they invested or 1 times the money they invested. It leaves a really small window for making money. But that's what their LPs expect from them. But that's not what your corporation expects from you, nor your shareholders. So it's a completely different way of looking at that business, right?
It is. But what the VCs can do, if you partner with them right, can actually set you up so you can, and that's why we joined a couple of those big funds, was they are very good for market scanning. So they're a very good source for that. They also are a good monetary source, but they are a great safe way for you to invest if you choose to invest, because they will bring on a different structure and a different regimen to an outcome than you will as a corporation. And we found that for us, the sweet spot was partnering. So we invested via VCs rather than creating our own.
Yeah. It's a good model, I think, right? So you become a limited partner in their fund. You get all the benefits of doing it. You don't have to manage it. You don't have to worry about it. And your expectations are aligned, right? But also you get potential partner flow as well on the other side, because their best companies should be your partners at some level, no?
Yeah. And the smart VCs also look at it as, if I can get a group of smart companies as investors,
right,
that gives me a very good pilot base to actually bring together to test my investments. Because let's be honest, it's a VC fund. One thing you really want to know is, how quickly do I stop investing in something, right, as well as whether something's going to be successful. And you need those pilots and that structure to understand, okay, maybe this isn't going anywhere.
So what was your experience like working with startups when you were part of the customer lab, if you can go into that a little bit?
It probably drove why I created this idea of Ikigai Partners, which is, startups are very, very good at solving their particular problem.
Right.
What I also found was that they are not very good at working with corporations, and B, are not great at understanding the economics behind how a company makes money. And I think that's the bit that is really important, because for something to work in a company, it needs to actually deliver a return. It doesn't, sometimes that could be a retention return, it could be a financial return, it could be a cost saving return. It doesn't matter, but you need to understand the economics behind how a company makes money. And, you know, the amount of companies I met who came to me saying, we are going to help your claims line because we're going to make people healthier. Now, if I had been sitting in the US, that would have been a great statement. But sitting across a portfolio that operated in markets where you exclude chronic and pre-existing,
right,
actually meant that it had no impact to the bottom line.
Got it.
And it's that side of things where, when you work in a regulated sector,
yep,
and you can't avoid it, I found that most of the companies we worked with, even to get to pilot, because we did have our own accelerator program, the length of time it took to get to pilot was much greater than we expected.
Why?
Because all the work we had to do to get them either compliant, so if they had a device, it was suddenly, are you an EU regulated device? Ooh, what's that? Okay, we need to get you a regulated device structure. Or we need to get your security signed off by our risk people. Or we need to understand how your technology is going to do. Or there's the privacy side of things, because you're working with data, which in most markets is classed as sensitive.
Right.
So therefore needs the highest order of protection. So it sort of is, you can sort of, they use the mentality fail fast, and you can fail fast to a point, but you can't fail fast in health, and you certainly can't fail fast in privacy.
Right. I was going to ask you that question, right? Because I was told by another insurance company last week that they tell their startups that they work with that they shouldn't expect any revenue or anything for like 18 to 24 months, 18 months to 2 years. And I was wondering like why it takes so long. And I think you've just elucidated that really nicely, but go ahead.
Yeah, it is really hard. You know, like even we worked with a wonderful startup out of a London-based French one called Spixi, which does an AI chatbot. Great way to sell health insurance.
Yep.
And we actually did get up and running. But the complexity in a regulated market where the regulator needs to know all the answers that bot is going to get totally dumbs down its AI very quickly. Or you go to somewhere like Hong Kong where the medical regulations are such that only doctors in Hong Kong who are trained in Hong Kong or have been approved by the Hong Kong regulator can provide health recommendations, and they are not allowed to market their services, means that you can't turn on a health AI symptom checker because it's just against the law.
It's illegal.
So how do you dumb it down to just giving advice and recommendations and all this stuff? You've got particularly in insurance, whether it's insurance or medical or whatever, they have these regulations in each market. So you can't just pick something up and drop it in the next one and drop it in the next one.
Right.
And so it's tricky.
What's your view on some of these regulatory sandboxes that some of the commissions have set up? I know there's one in Thailand, and I know there's one being set up in some other countries. But what's your view on that for making this process speedier? In other words, you can test. Like you said, you can't fail in health. You can't fail in life. You just don't want to have those things happen. But if you're in the sandbox, maybe it's easier to sort of test it with the knowledge that it may fail. What's your view on that?
Oh, look, I think probably the leading sandbox in InsurTech is sitting in London, and the regulator there and what they've built is just phenomenal. Like, there is a reason why there is some amazing InsurTech and bank tech stuff happening out of London.
Yeah,
it's because of
amazing.
The regulator. I believe that firmly. And what they did with open banking and so forth. I had a brief chat with Teresa on what's been set up in Thailand. Again, a great start, but it's got to go all the way through. So just having it there doesn't really mean a lot. It's a bit like building an accelerator or a laboratory or a space where people can work out. It's a good start. But how do you then get all the way through so you can turn the sandbox into something that can then evolve? And I think that's where I look at most of the markets the regulators haven't worked out. And that's why I think London is still the beacon for InsurTech and FinTech, is because the regulator not only has worked out their sandbox, but it's worked out the journey path from the sandbox to live.
Interesting.
Like, open banking has allowed the banks that came out of the FinTech sandbox to come to life. Without open banking, they could have done all this beautiful sandbox stuff, and then it would have been, but how do we get it out there?
Right.
It just would have been lost. And I think that's the nuance that the regulators, and it's actually less the regulators, more that the governments are needing to work with those regulators to support the learnings from the sandbox that are hindering these companies from then taking their solutions, the ones that make sense, not all of them will, but the ones that make sense, turning them into reality. And that's where the real crux of all this innovation is. And you see most markets where it falls over.
I want to go into this thing you brought up, a little bit of the wellness and insurance intersection. I want to get to that in a second, but I'm really curious about this thing you talked about in London, where you say that there's all this innovation going on there, and part of it's because of the regulators and the way the government works together and the way they work just inside the industry and building out this proper infrastructure so things can come out there whole. I'm really curious. One of the things we see out here, right, is that a lot of the InsurTech startups are trying to get into the distribution space, right? Because penetration here is so low. So they try to create innovative ways to distribute insurance products and then distribute new insurance products while the existing incumbent players, you know, underwrite it for them. Are you seeing something, mm-hmm. or did you see different stuff in London and by extension, I guess, in Europe, where you're having full stack brand new insurance companies get grown, right? Because the underwriting is the thing. It's not the only thing, right? But it's one of the things that it just requires a ton of capital, a ton of investment experience, right? Most people don't know that an insurance company on the other side has an investment management arm. That's how they provide the funds to make claims. But are you seeing different innovation in London than you are in Asia?
Look, I think the only difference is the reinsurers are being the underwriters. So between Munich and Swiss. So if you look at a lot of the a number of the smaller insurer players that are coming out, which are playing a distribution segmentation arm, what's underwriting them are the reinsurers, not the general insurers.
Got it.
And I think that's a bit of a nuance.
It is.
And I think it's an interesting thing to look forward to, which is how long or will the reinsurers stay in this space, particularly given that they are going about to go through probably an even worse year than the last few years because of just the incidents of claims that are coming out of starting in my home country, but I think probably going through with the impact of climate change.
Yeah. You and I were talking about this offline a little bit, and I just thought we could probably do an entire series, not just a show, but just an entire series on what the implication for these types of events are going to be as climate change gets, in my mind, worse and worse, but just other things that are ancillary to that as well. What impact is that going to have on the insurance industry? Not just their ability to insure things, but their ability to remain solvent in the face of massive potential claims. I don't know. We probably shouldn't even delve into that, but I just think it's a very interesting topic, yeah.
It's a scary one, but I think, you know, with London, the big difference is, yes, there are a few starting out who are backing themselves, but most of them are being backed by the reinsurers.
Yep. Makes sense. Okay. I just want to ask you one more question about one of the things that you learned at Bupa, and that is, on the flip side, right, what are insurers looking for when they're dealing with startups? What do they want?
It's really three areas they're looking at. One is process improvement. So they're looking at doing their back end better. I think two is around intelligence. So whether that be AI on claims or customer service or understanding your pricing better. So one is around process, one is around intelligence in the brains, and three, it is new offerings or new capabilities that can disrupt components of the market they're in or allow them to enter new markets.
Okay, that's interesting. And did you see a lot of that when you were at Bupa? When you were in the customer lab, did you see a lot of that? Did you see a lot of startups working on those types of things?
The startups today, if you look at the journey that we've been in InsurTech, a lot of it has been around existing processes and automating them and making them run more efficient. A lot of them have been around claims, whether that be claims management all the way through to claims fraud, because let's be honest, underpinning an insurance business is a claims business.
Right.
And that's where your outliers really go. So that claims management piece is vital, and you see across the board. What you were starting to see was the opportunity that InsurTech did to offering benefits or connections to customers. It may not necessarily be a new product, but it may be adding new features and new benefits. So if you take one of the big focuses of Bupa over the last couple of years has been mental health, because we're starting to see that as a massive impact for employers. And Bupa predominantly sells their product to employers.
Right.
So how could you work with startups in that space to give you solutions that were both cost-effective and outcome-effective to your customers around that space? So that's what I mean by connecting to other areas or enhancing your product. And I think you'll start seeing companies use startups a lot in that space.
Right. So one of the other words that you used earlier, right at the beginning of this conversation, was engagement. And you said insurance itself is not so engaging. But with this kind of very laser focus on customers, right, and the idea that maybe that the broker is going to sort of slip away a little bit but not get eliminated permanently, how do you see this engagement happening between insurance companies and their customers? And how do startups help them with that engagement? And what is engagement in your mind as well?
Well, I think, I can't remember which company I got it from, but they always talk about the toothbrush test, which is if you can get something to be like a toothbrush, you're really connected with your customer.
What does that mean?
So, because, well, every morning most people hopefully brush their teeth, and each night they brush their teeth. They actually have a connection with it.
Yeah, fair enough.
It is part of their life, is interacting with it. So how do you take insurance? And, you know, we've got, if you look at critical illness, life, which is like probably once a year you may be engaged by a bill payment, even health, where, you know, 90% plus of people are healthy, so hence not engaging with it. How do you get someone to flip that on its head and turn the engagements piece into that? And the reality is your physical health and your mental health are two things that we do engage in and we do connect in. And I think that is the real opportunity that we have in terms of driving that forward. So you look at companies like Aon with their Well One platform, Vitality have done the same thing. They're not necessarily today using that to interact any of their pricing models or to bring their costs down or whatever. But what they are building is an ability to connect with their customers around something they care about rather than something they pay for on the hope it doesn't happen. How do we make insurance, whilst at its core is covering things that we don't want to have happen?
Right.
But how do we allow you to engage in things where by you doing it every day, you increase the possibility of it not happening?
So this is the intersection that we talked about offline as well between employee wellness and insurance and then the InsurTech. Do you want to talk a little bit about how those things work together? Fucking perfect segue, well, by the way. I don't know how you did that.
Yeah. Oh, cool. I think the key thing for, you know, if you're an employer, you want your people to be healthy.
Sure.
Both in terms of just availability to work, but also in terms of morale and general employment satisfaction. And underpinning most insurance is a healthy person in the space I work in. Now, employers are learning and learning rapidly. Like, we've done lots of work around the environment in which we work in, the services we do, and now we're learning about mental health and the impact that's happening. And that is actually going strongly through Asia as much as anywhere else. It was sort of, there was this perception that the mental health focus wasn't going to be as strong in Asia as it would be in other markets. But all the work I've seen showing that it's as big an issue, if not more, because of the working styles and environments in Asia.
Yeah, yeah.
Are actually driving this as a big factor. So how do you support that and how do you bring that to life? Now, This is where the insurer or the broker, depending on who he or she is interacting with, has a real opportunity through some of the work that startups are doing to actually deliver some great outcomes. Like, I really recommend that anyone has a go at this lovely little app called Wobot. It's done by a company out of Silicon Valley, and it's basically a mental health support app.
How do you spell it?
Wobot. W-O-E-B-O-T.
Wobot. Got it.
You can sign up for it. It doesn't cost anything. It's based on cognitive-based therapy. And there's a lot of research now starting to show that cognitive-based therapy can actually be delivered more effectively electronically than it can be in person.
Interesting.
Because it's available when you need it is the biggest underlying factor. But you can start to see how you can engage. It's a great example of how you can engage with customers. There's a company called Lantern. They didn't make it, but raised a lot of funding who tried to do something with humans. So had human psychologists at the other end.
Right.
That didn't prove to be economically feasible.
Doesn't scale.
Wobot is a computer and does seem to scale. There's equivalent to sitting in the UK, which the NHS is doing support work for and so forth. So I think where you have this lovely intersection is it's very hard for a startup to get into a corporation, particularly around employment health, employee engagement, and all those things. The insurance company actually has a very good connection into these companies.
Yeah.
Now, why do these people offer insurance? It's to get the best people because, you know, you can be in a country like Singapore where the insurance package you offer to the executives really matters, and it matters in many of these countries. So they want a good product, but how do you make your product a bit more unique other than just it's good if you are sick? This is what we're going to do to keep you healthy. And there's that really lovely symbiotic relationship where startup to insurer to company can actually bring a really nice space. And I think that's the real opportunity. And that's the opportunity I see because I think insurance is going to be harder and harder to sell on its own, particularly as we go through the generations. And it's not even really a generation thing. We're all much more focused on I want it now rather than I do something for the future. It's not a generational thing. I think it's just a impact of life today thing. So therefore, insurers, I think, are under more and more pressure to say, how can I deliver you value now? And it's not going to be a claims experience because you don't want to be sick or you don't want to be injured or you don't want to break your leg or whatever.
No.
So I think a wellness piece is integral to it. And I think it's the same with employers. Like, you know, we've all got these equivalent, everyone coming I've worked for has this equivalent of these employee assistance programs, which, you know, you can dial a number if you need help. I think you can count on one hand the amount of people in the company who use them because it's all reactive.
Yeah, they're yucky anyway, but yeah.
Yeah, they're yucky. I do think this is where technology has a massive opportunity. Apologies to all the EAP providers. But I do think this switch is quite powerful. But I think in today's world, startups would struggle to get into a corporation to do it.
I mean, I think I know why, but from your perspective, right, what are the mistakes that a startup makes when it's trying to get into a corporation, when it's trying to create that relationship, particularly if it's one where, you know, look, like if I used to work at Goldman Sachs, and if I built a fintech company and I wanted to sell some of those services to Goldman, I would know who to call, I'd know who to go, like I would know the internals, right? But without having that, what are the mistakes that they make that you've seen?
The biggest thing is they don't understand how they make money.
Really?
Yeah. They think they know how they make money. They don't understand. The second big mistake is, and it has to be a mistake because it's why startups exist, is they think their solution is the be-all and end-all. Now,
fair enough.
And they need to be that singularly focused to be successful. So I don't want it to go away. The challenge is, but their solution in 99.9995% of times will be part of a piece of a puzzle to a big corporate.
Right.
It's not a solution. And I think the third one sort of plays to that is, yes, they could have an impact on a corporation. But remember, corporations can own, like I always liken to Bupa. I always said, and Vodafone or any of the other companies I work with, we could only handle 2 to 3 big change pieces of work at any one time. Any more than that, by the time you bring in the communications to employees, and when you've got like 70,000 plus employees, you can't afford to be communicating something new every day. By the time you look into your systems, because to make it actually adopted by that company, unless they want to do it standalone, it's going to have connecting back-end systems.
It's going to integrate,
systems
yeah.
Worked.
Yeah.
And it's not the only thing that's being integrated.
Right.
So there's only so much capacity. And I think there's an unrealistic expectation from startups about the speed they can move versus the speed a company can move. And by the company moving slowly, it's stupid.
Right.
And I've heard that term used many times by startups.
Yeah.
Now, they can be, and companies can be really slow. And that's why we set up the lab, which is to work at that, a bit like the way project managers used to exist, which is how do you sit between business and technology?
Right.
This was about how do you sit between startups and business? Because you have a soap opera that comes with startups in many cases. Like,
yeah.
These are passionate. Like, the strength is also a weakness, and we all have that same situation. But in this case, you know, their passion is their weakness and their strength. So how do you control that without them going in there and, you know, literally telling your board that they will completely change the face of medicine in the UK,
right,
by the way, I have heard. Managing that credibility factor. And I think that's the other piece whereby I think the accelerator labs and other places are there for a reason to help startups actually understand what it's going to take. Unfortunately, most of the labs out there are better, teach them to be better startups, which if they want to be a standalone business is fine. But if they want to sell within a business, they've got to find those accelerators and labs that actually teach them to work within a corporate. And there's not many of them.
No, not really. And what's the reverse? In other words, the last thing I'll ask is so much ground to cover, right? But I don't want to take up more of your time. But the last thing I'll ask you is, what recommendations do you have in reverse for big companies, big insurance companies, reinsurance companies, for them to kind of deal better with the startups?
For me, I think the biggest thing is have your focus. If you're bringing in a startup which is going to compete squarely with your core business,
right,
I think you'll fail. I think if you can bring in a startup that will work with one of your core businesses, let it go into adjacent spaces or take a sub-segment of it, it will do really well. Because it's really hard. And I actually lived for this once, which was, this was with a company, a bank in Australia, that actually had an accelerator lab. They came up with a solution, was within their core solution today, and they were pitching it to me.
Okay.
The person who owned the core business actually said to me, but this generates $100 million to our bottom line.
Right.
I can't afford for you to do that other thing because it won't. And I think this is the real challenge with corporations, is that to work successfully with startups, you need to be able to look 5 years out.
Yeah.
This is not a 1 or 2 year journey. So if you're in it for 1 or 2 years, don't do it. Just don't, because it won't get you there. So therefore, that's why I always say to startups, pitch something that is adjacent to a business you're in today. Because there's very few companies who are brave enough to look at cannibalizing their existing business, but stick with that for 5 years for it to go somewhere.
Right.
Because it will take that long.
It will take that long. So actually, I have one more question for you, and then I'll let you go. But what you didn't say is, why did you leave to start Ikigai? What is it going to do? What is it going to be? Do you know what I mean? And I know what Ikigai means. We talked about it. But what is the idea for this, and how are you going to keep interacting in this insurance, insurtech, startup, finance space with this company?
So I left just purely because, for family reasons, I had to move back to Australia.
Yep.
So it was as simple as that.
Fair enough.
The whole idea with this is I saw lots of venture capital firms. What I didn't see was anyone who could actually move from what is the next generation accelerator, and that means how do you build something commercially,
right,
into an experience rather than stand alone. And look, my passion is med tech. It really is. So my focus is very much looking at the hospital sector, okay, and how can they play in this space. So I think there's insurance, which is risk management today.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there'll be subscriptions, risk management in a different way going further.
Okay.
And I think that will be another big space. And that's the area that I'm really interested in, which is, how do non-insurers go into this space in the health and use technology to do so? But how do they work with payers? Because my big learning from working with startups in medical, and it really is in the medical and insurance space, and this is why I connect with insurance, is if you're trying to build an insurance product, you can go build it, sell it to someone, and you're done. If you're doing something in the medical space, I can get the consumer wanting it. They might love it, but if the doctor doesn't want to do it, they won't do it.
Right.
If the doctor loves it, but the hospital won't provide access to it, it won't happen. And more importantly, if the payer, which can be either government or private, won't cover it, it really won't happen. Now, what's interesting is Germany just passed some laws in November, which actually allowed for insurance companies to cover app support and digital health. So they are starting down that journey of how you can do that. And I think that's the real nuance in the space I want to work in, is helping startups actually commercialize their space. Because I've seen so many fantastic ideas that could actually change people's health, right, not just in the Western world, but actually with remote care, this into the third world quite dramatically.
Yeah.
But they can't get this provider, payer, consumer trilogy. It really is a trilogy that you're solving for. And that's where what I've set Ikigai up to help companies like that. So I'm like, literally how I connected with Teresa is I'm helping a chronic pain management company called Alina out of London.
Awesome. I know Alina. We work with them, yeah.
Yeah. So that was where this came about was. And literally, they're a great example. They came to pitch to me at Bupa, and they did the class startup thing, which is we can reduce your costs. It's like, we don't cover that.
You're right.
Alina might be talking about that, but that's literally how that came about.
That's okay.
But I love the idea. And it's how do we make those things happen, which is what drove me to set this up.
That's perfect. And it's also a great way to end, John. Look, I really want to thank you, John Moore, the founder of Ikigai Partners, for coming on and doing this today.
You're welcome. Thank you. It was fun.